Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're off. We're off. Here we go. Here it is. It's another week. Another pod radio show. It's podcast. Most people listen to the podcast, do they? I don't know.
We don't know the figures. We don't know the breakdowns.
Don't know the figures. Don't know how it works. Only know what we get paid. So we mainly do this out of love. So you're listening to Five Star Family Fun Size Fan Club. My name is Nick. The people call me Nick. And this is Nathaniel
Metcalf.
What's your middle name?
George.
George.
Nathaniel George Metcalf.
George Metcalf.
Write it down, then you can people remember it. Yeah. At home, if you're listening.
Make a note of it, guys.
You'll be hearing that name again next week, probably on...
Next week, or maybe a bit later when when we introduce a guest to him. I like the fact that to make you feel better, a lot of the guests pretend that they don't know who I am as well. So.
It's nice. I mean, it's only polite, isn't it, of them? It's good on
them. I think it's bloody rude, considering I know 75% of all of our guests. but then by the end of the hour we spend with them, I like to feel like, you know, it's 78% of the guests, you know. Okay, but you know, I'm very grateful for the content. So here we go. We are this is another week. We talked exclusively about if you've never heard the show before, this is it. slick as it's gonna get. first rule of fan club: tell your friends.
Tell your friends.
Second rule of fan club:
please, for the love of God, tell your
friends. I beat you to it. Friends. So last week we talked an hour about the series Masters of the Universe Revelations. I'd seen 4 out of 5 of the released episodes and Nathaniel had seen none.
Yeah.
But still managed to get an hour out of it. That gives you an idea of just... And Nathaniel had loads of stuff that he'd seen that he wanted to talk about. But we got priorities. Just a quick update on the Masters of the Universe Revelations.
Yeah.
I have since seen the 5th episode. Uh-huh. I do think it is a bit weird. I think they would have been much better off to have just been up front with all the marketing and just said, He-Man's not really in it.
Yeah. Or made a point of saying, what's the series? Oh, we're doing a spin-off of Masters of the Universe, which is entirely about Teela.
I think that you're all right, because it used to be called He-Man and the Masters of the Universe in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And so just to leave He-Man off the title and call it Masters of the Universe, I think that's all right.
Right? Or like they do in Star Wars and they say, what they call Star Wars
Story? Star Wars Story, yeah. They could have called it, they could have said Masters of the Universe, Teela's, you know, Teela's Adventure or whatever, you know. These are all, I think it was really weird. When we were editing Heavy Entertainment, I had to choose between a poem. I didn't have to choose between a poem. I wanted to put a poem in, mm-hmm. and the producer wanted to put a joke in, and it got quite heated because I just thought the poem made more sense on a structural level, right? The poem, although didn't have a huge payoff and wasn't like it was funny, but it wasn't sort of like a belly laugh, right? Right. But what it did was it set up character and it set up kind of like themes that would pay off later. Yeah.
It's richer. It's a richer choice.
Yeah. Whereas the joke was kind of like you laugh and then you move on. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to kind of like go put the laugh in. And I was just like, I want to put the poem in because it sets more stuff up for the episode in the series. And then it got quite heated and I had to just calm them down and just say, hey, I wrote both of them. I love them equally. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I love, you know, I wrote them. I only put them in because I'm proud of the, you know, I think that they're worth being in the show. But when it comes down to it, this one does something different to that one.
Yeah.
And I think, and
presumably that, there are other jokes in the show.
There are other jokes in the show. It's not like, anyway, so my point about Masters of the Universe is you can love all of these characters, you know. Mm-hmm. But if you're marketing it as specifically a thing, and then it's not that thing, then, and people are like going, what happened to that thing that you marketed?
Yeah.
Then you can kind of like see why people are sort of.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You can see if it's not what is sort of being advertised. Whereas if all the way through they were saying, I'm Kevin Smith and I've had an idea for a He-Man spin-off series, people go, all right, I might watch that. I used to like He-Man.
Well, the thing is, yeah, the title of the show is called Master of the Universe. It's not got He-Man in the title. So you don't need to say it's a He-Man show if you've not even included him in the title of the show.
Right.
But when they brought out the trailer for it,
sure,
it was He-Man fighting Skeletor to, I think it's a cover version, or it might have been like a remix of I Need a Hero, right, by Bonnie Tyler, right? And it's just He-Man and Skeletor fighting each other for like a minute and a half, right? All of that footage is taken from the beginning of the first episode before he gets killed, right? And then, and it's kind of like, you go, oh, sure. And when you get to the end of the series, where, which is like midway through the run, and there's going to be another five, when you get to the end of it, yeah, they kind of bring him back and then they sort of get rid of him again. And it's kind of like, oh, all right, yeah. Again, you've got to listen to the last episode. I'm not going to go into it for any longer than this, really. But it's just sort of like, I do think it is absolutely, but I don't stand by. Like, it was Kevin Smith's birthday today. He must have had an absolutely shit birthday. everyone's trying to cancel him. He's being sort of like attacked by both sides now. Like, people are saying, you know, you've gone woke, and people are saying that you're basically using LGBTQ themes in order to sell a product. You know what I mean? It's kind of like,
can't win.
You can't win.
Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
So maybe the best thing to do for people is to just try and tell a story.
But is that like, would that be, I understand what you're saying, that it's not selling itself as a He-Man product, but it's selling itself as a...
It is selling itself as a He-Man product. Yeah. It is not a He-Man product.
Yeah. If you went to see... actually, that's not true, is it? I was going to say, if you went to see a band that have like a lead singer and a group... If you went to see Elvis Costello and the Attractions in 1981, would you be like, it's the Attraction? It's actually, it's just me. I'm just Steve, was he called Steve Naive? I'm Steve Naive, and it's, I'm here. And you go, where's Elvis Costello? He goes, he's not here. He's dead.
Well, I went to see Journey. And
oh, yeah.
When we went to see Journey, the band came out, and then the lead singer came out. And it wasn't Steve Perry. I think that's the lead singer of Journey. And the whole of Wembley Arena lit up with Wikipedia as everyone was like going, who the fuck is this? I tell you what it would be like. It would be like marketing Halloween Resurrection on the final showdown between Jamie Lee Curtis and Michael Myers. And then you pay money to see Jamie Lee Curtis, and then she dies 2 minutes in, and you're like, huh. And then you have to watch Busta Rhymes kickboxing
and Kung Fu
kicking Michael Myers for 90 minutes. Yeah. It would be a bit like the marketing executive decision as a Steven Seagal vehicle, and not even mentioning Kurt Russell. When you watch it, it's like, oh, it's a Kurt Russell film. It's like... Yeah, it's kind of like, it's why would you do that? But it's not, because it's like, because part of me thinks that, you know, everyone's calling it a bait and switch, and you go, fine, okay, but that's worked very successfully in the past with stuff like Psycho, right?
Yeah.
Where that's got one of the best, it's a twist. It's a storytelling thing, it's a twist, and you kind of like go, oh, but it feels... you don't feel like you feel like that's plot driven. You know, it's kind of like, here we go, we're making a film about this thing, and we want you to be as shocked as the characters would be shocked. So we're doing a thing. So we're going to get rid of one of the main characters, like really early on, and you're going to be like, "Well, who's the lead?" And then you realise it's this other character. You know, that's clever, but you're basing it entirely on 40-year-old nostalgia for something that already exists, and you're saying you're going to get this thing that already exists, and then you're making it into something completely different. And
I mean, I suppose it's also it's made worse by the fact there's been an absence. Like, as we established last week, we don't really care about He-Man, despite talking for an hour about it. But, I guess you haven't had it for 40 years and you loved it and you're going, well, there's a new series. I love it. I love it. So I can't wait to see He-Man again.
I think everyone would acknowledge that those original episodes, or most people would acknowledge that those original episodes, as an adult, if you went back and watched them, they're not very sophisticated. They're not great stories, but they're like this. There's this iconography that, you know, like we said last week, there's this iconography that's lasted all this time, and what all this iconography is really calling out for is a decent story and someone to just handle it properly and go ta-da, because they fucked it up with the films, they fucked it up with subsequent TV series of Masters of the Universe that they brought out, where that this is like the first big push to go, we're going to do this properly this time, guys. It's going to actually, if anything, be better than the series that you grew up with, because we've got all of, you know, we know what we're doing more. It's not just a toy line anymore. It's like this franchise, and I think that's what's really exciting about it. Taking a fairly two-dimensional character, fleshing it out, or a series of two-dimensional characters and a world, fleshing it out for like a grown-up audience. You know, not just in terms of age, but in terms of sophistication. You know, kids are a lot more sophisticated than they were back then, and doing some sort of like something interesting with this really cool property, where it's like it's science fiction, it's fantasy, it's barbarians, it's cowboys, it's, you know, medieval knights. It's just all of this stuff, like all put together. It's kind of like what are you going to do with it? And they could have done a lot of things with it, and also they could have made absolutely everyone happy. There, it's all there. You know, it's impossible to understand. I can understand them fucking it up because it's just boring. And I suppose one of the things that I thought was really impressive, and then we'll move on, right? One of the things that I thought was really impressive was that Kevin Smith, you know, he's been getting a lot of hate, and I think it's fairly unfair. He's kind of done. He is part of a committee. He is the showrunner, but he's, and I think that people are saying that he's lied to the fans about what the show's about. I think he was really just trying to protect what they'd worked on, you know, the secrets of the show that he'd worked on, without giving it all away.
Of course.
So that there was stuff for us to discover, or for people to discover. But I think he said, you know, one of the things was that he said that in interviews in the past, like years ago, he said he was never really a Masters of the Universe fan. And then he got this job, and then he was just like, I love Masters of the Universe. I think what's really interesting is that I fully believe that he loves the show that he made, and that they tried to do something interesting with it, and tried to do something different, and they tried to do something contemporary, and they looked around at what everyone else is doing at the moment, and they said, well, let's do something modern like that. And they did that. And I think it's more miraculous, rather than having a guy that's a fan that got hired by a corporation to make something for the fans. Yes. They got someone that wasn't particularly a fan of the property because it's two-dimensional. He was 15 or like in his mid-teens when it came out. Who would be a fan of He-Man at that age if it was brand new, right? Especially if Conan the Barbarian was at the cinema that was aimed at your age. It's like, why? So to take someone that isn't a fan, and then through working on a project, they create something that they're really interested in and they're really proud of. And by the end of that process, they are a massive fan. They're converted, you know?
Yeah, and actually, the way these projects probably come about is that someone's approached him and he's gone, you know what, I'm not really interested in that. And then by a process of going, if I was going to do it, how would I do it? and you just sort of maybe spent an afternoon thinking, well, if I was going to do it, I'd probably do something like this. And they sent it back, and it's gone through all the processes, and usually at some point all these projects stall somewhere, and this one just hasn't stalled, and it's got through like almost the kind of thing where if, and he probably hasn't given it a tremendous amount of thought, but he's given it enough thought like, well, it's an offer. Let's see what I can come up with. I'm getting paid to write a treatment or write a version of it. And that's all he came up with. And he said, how about this? And after he's done it, he's gotten, you know, he's worked out of, well, if I was going to make a Master Universe cartoon, what would I want it to be like? And then he writes something up, go, yeah, this is sort of what I'd like to see in it. I'm not a big fan, but I can kind of go, yeah, if I was doing it, I'd probably do it something like this. It's like if someone said, like, as you were saying, you're not a big James Bond fan, but if someone said to you, if the Broccolis came to you and said, Nick, we'd love you to come up with an idea for James Bond, and we'll pay you to give us a little pitch or something, you'd probably spend an afternoon going, I'll have a think about it, and you'd come up with it, and you'd probably get to the point where you would have a version of it. You've gone, hey, I've got some ideas, because that's what you're being asked to do, right? You're being asked to come to them with ideas of what you might do. And they can pay for those ideas. They're basically paying for your ideas to have a bit of input or whatever. And you go, yeah, I guess if I was doing it, I'd probably do X, Y, and Z. And Mattel have gone, Kevin, we love this. And he goes, oh, yeah, no, I thought it was a good idea. And it's just developed.
And he's run
again
with
and
it.
Again. He's run with it. And it's totally, and actually as someone who works in the entertainment industry as a writer and a director, being hired as a writer, all he's done really is his job, right? At every point, he's probably just been done exactly what he's been asked to do.
Well, he's head of he's head of the writing group. He's not.
Oh, right. Okay.
He's not written it. He's written a couple of episodes, but he's not the sole writer. So it's like a team. There's a team of writers. There's a team of people that are doing it, and they're all throwing their ideas in. I think maybe that initial idea was maybe a bit of a misstep.
Hmm.
I just think there's a word that. It's just, I do think it's absolutely, I just can't get my head around it, which is why we're talking about it.
Sure.
Because.
But again, I guess what I'm saying there is, whatever's happened, and you're saying it's Kevin Smith's birthday, he's probably having a horrible one, is that whatever happened, it's not really Kevin Smith's fault. Because surely this will have gone through Mattel or whoever owns He-Man. He's not made them do anything with He-Man.
It's like J.J. Abrams with Star Wars, and everyone's kind of like, he is part of the problem, but. He's not the sole problem. It's not just Lucasfilm, it's Disney as well.
Yeah, so it's like it's someone's made a decision, or a number of people have made a decision.
And Netflix. Which is,
rather than it being this guy who's been involved with it. Because you can totally see, like, let's say someone said, Nick, would you like to do a remake updating of Master Universe? You'd probably go, I don't know. It was certainly not a dream of mine. Well, I'll certainly go away and have a think about it for a bit, and I'll come back with some ideas.
But I think that world is so rich that you could do... I do think it's bonkers that they were given it, and then this is what they did. And you go, why? Why? You could have done something interesting and new and not what everyone else seems to be doing with their franchises. Yeah. And you could have literally made everyone happy. It's just people seem to be averse to crowd-pleasing at the moment.
Yeah. You
know? And it's like, kind of like, just do the thing, you know? Do another three Star Wars films, put Luke Skywalker in them, kill him off at the end, and you can introduce loads of other characters. Do another He-Man, do another James Bond. And while you're doing it, while you're at it, guys, do a load of spin-offs, introduce a load of new characters.
Well, I was always that way with, like, the... when they did that reboot of... They've done two Fantastic Four movies.
Oh, yeah.
None of which, like, neither of which...
They've done three,
like Fantastic Four. Oh, yeah, you've done three movies, but none of them are like Fantastic Four's meant to be. So it's almost... And then the last one they did was almost like, well, let's do a complete reimagining. It's like, you can't do a reimagining unless you've established one that's like a prop. Do one, which is like, that's your... And then you can do little spin-offs of it, because you've got one where you know... And the audience, more importantly, understands that you're doing a take on a thing.
Yeah.
Whereas, like... Even though they might go, everyone knows about Fantastic Four. It's like, well, they don't, because most of the public don't know who those characters are.
That's what Marvel Studios have done really well.
Exactly.
That DC have absolutely fucked every single time. DC are constantly doing kind of like hot takes on characters. They're like going, what if we did Superman, only we made him really sad and we made it like a heavy metal video and we had loads of killing in it and it was really depressing and it's not really that fun. And we set it in the real world. And you go, yeah, you could do that. But you know when the last Superman film was made? 40 years ago. Why don't you just do a Superman film? And then was it? And it's my argument with the Christopher Nolan Batman films, which was you got a guy that's embarrassed to be making Batman films. So you just like, you know, that's why I think the animated series of Batman is most people's favourite version of Batman. Mm. Because they do the thing. Yeah, they bring elements to it and it's all sort of like art deco and it's informed by other things. It's informed by, we're not making Adam West, we're going to make him a dark psychological character. It's still for kids, but it doesn't feel like it's talking down to kids.
Yeah.
And it's and I go, that, for me, as a massive Batman fan, that is the ultimate version of Batman. And
yeah.
Every film adaptation has been kind of like someone's take on it.
Sure.
Whereas with Marvel, you kind of like go, that is Iron Man.
Yes.
And if you're going to do another Iron Man, you've got to find a hot take on where you'll take that character.
And actually, if you were Kevin Smith and you went, they're doing a new Master Universe cartoon, they go, well, the kind of gold standard for children's cartoons is probably the 90s Batman cartoon. And we'll have that on a mood board and say, we want it to be for kind of all ages. So kids can watch it. But if you're the dad or whatever, or someone who watched it, you can watch it with your kid or you can watch it anyway and be entertained by it and go, Joe, what? That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's fine.
It's just something for it. You just go, well, we'll take what you've done and you will do it like better.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll age it up a bit. The animation is better. The storytelling is more sophisticated. We're not doing one-off episodes. We're doing a series where each episode follows onto each other. So we don't have to do individual stories, you know, and adventures. We can tell a bigger story. That's enough, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
And we can also say He-Man's off on a mission doing something else. And T-Dar's doing this. And then no one can complain because everyone loves T-Dar from the original series anyway. Is what they're saying, but who knows? I think people, I don't know, part of me is that people want to be offended, and part of me is that it's insane what they decided to do anyway. What have you been a fan of this week?
Well, I know we're trying to move away from it, but I was just about to say that years ago it really stuck with me. I read a review of the film Mystery Men and the review was by former fan clubber Kim Newman, and he was talking about how good the film is, except the problem with it, and he predicted it's not going to really take off, which it didn't, because he said that currently there isn't really equivalent of this in cinema. So what it's doing, it's mocking superhero teams and supervillains and all this, and he's saying, but really, they haven't done the groundwork yet. And you think now, in 2021, you could make a film like Mystery Men. They sort of have.
With, you know, you've got Deadpool.
Yeah.
I haven't seen The Boys. Is The Boys sort of like that?
I haven't seen The Boys, but yeah, I presume it's like that. And he said, this is the thing where he predicts it kind of doesn't work. He goes, it works, but it works when you know what it's referencing. Well, and you go, that's right. And it's a smart way of thinking about it, that you've got to remember that a lot of your audience aren't familiar with these tropes, and it's using tropes from comics and putting them in a different medium with the idea that the audience is fully up to speed on the same tropes.
It was weird. The late 90s, mid to late 90s, it's just really weird how slow. I am sick to fucking death of superhero movies. It's really weird how slow it has been to get, you know, like we said the other week, like Superman was 78, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. 79? Yeah. And then Batman was 89. And then they made like four Batman films between 89 and 97. And then in between all of that, you had stuff like Dick Tracy, which was like Batman works. Let's do Dick Tracy. And you go, yeah. What? Why would you do Dick Tracy?
Well, that's it. It's the same principle as what's the biggest film of the year? Superman. Guys, next year, Popeye. It's the same principle.
And then, but then Dick Tracy wasn't a massive smash hit.
No.
So they went, let's do The Shadow. Let's do The Phantom. So you had those, which are sort of like, they're sort of the equivalent of Tarzan comics, as opposed, rather than Batman comics.
They're also like newspaper strip cartoons. So I think it's because they would be the comics that the older people in the 80s would have known about. So it's like, yes, I've never heard of these characters. Yeah. So if someone says, hey, let's do a Flash film, they're going, who? And it's like, no, Batman. Like, you mean like The Phantom?
Yeah, and it's like, but it's like, you know, all time travel films in the 80s were set in the 50s.
Yes.
And it's kind of like, yeah, because that was 30 years ago. That's how old you were, you know.
Yeah.
That was your childhood. That's what you're nostalgic for. And, so you had those, and then you maybe had like Spawn.
Yeah.
And Blade. And they were kind of, Spawn was, an independent comic book company, Image, mm-hmm. and they were desperate to sort of like, it was used as kind of like marketing for the comic books,
yeah,
as much as a film, and for the toys, and you know, the fact that Spawn got a film before lots of other, you know, Incredible Hulk and all this other stuff, and then Blade was like a lesser known Marvel character, but it was really like the first Marvel film. So, and then so in between all of that, you know, because things were 90s budgets, it was either like 120 million. I think I watched a thing, True Lies was the most expensive movie ever made in 1995, and it was 120 or 150 million. And so in between that, you've got stuff like Blank Man, and you got Meteor Man.
Yeah.
You've got these sort of like low budget, mid budget, spoof kind of films, because when you actually try and do when you try and do kind of like a mid-budget serious film, you end up with something like Steel, which is the Shaquille O'Neal film. All five of those in the 90s had black superhero leads. But there was like mid-range budget movies, mid to low budget. Meteor Man and Blank Man were kind of spoofs.
Yeah.
It was easier to. So when Mystery Men came along, I sort of liked Mystery Men, although I thought it was slightly too stylistic. Mm-hmm. And it was slightly too. It wasn't so much a spoof as just a straight out. Flat out comedy, but it was kind of like Ben Stiller being Ben Stiller before Ben Stiller. It was before Meet the Parents, but it was after.
That's what I mean. And it was doing a clever thing where its cast was like cast from lots of people who you kind of know from other things in supporting roles, or like, so it's like it's almost like as a team. You've basically got the equivalent of one big star, essentially.
Sure.
You go, oh, yeah, it's good. I like them. Oh, I've seen it. I like that guy. It was really good. Him.
It was an ensemble, is what you're looking
exactly.
For. It was an ensemble. And none of them were superstars, but it was a really good cast. And there's some good bits in it. And I remember enjoying it a lot. I saw it at the cinema. But yeah, you're right. There wasn't kind of like a definitive superhero film, which probably came along when they did Spider-Man, Spider-Man 2, and then X-Men.
Yes.
And Spider-Man and X-Men were both good films, and then they were both followed up by superior sequels, which was Spider-Man 2 and X-Men 2. And and then they all failed with terrible third films. It was just this weird time where they were kind of like pastiching stuff. But I just imagine it was cheaper. Although Mystery Men looks like it did have a budget. It had CGI, and the costumes looked expensive, and the sets looked expensive. I mean, it didn't look like they were like.
But it now seems like, again, for that reason, it almost makes you think, God, it's weird it got made. Because, like, who were they? How did they pitch it to people?
But it was based on a comic book.
Yeah, yeah, it's based on a Flaming Carrot.
And I imagined that the license for it was a lot cheaper than it was for...
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
For
yeah,
Superman.
Yeah.
And they were like, wait, we want to make a superhero film. This is quite a good comic. I enjoy reading this. Let's adapt this. You know, because Image have sort of gone ahead and made Spawn. And people were making lesser known. Like, the trend was, it was weird. We've done Batman, that's done really well. And then in the 90s, aside from Batman, every other superhero film that we make is going to be a lesser known, obscure comic book adaptation. You know, why wouldn't you instantly just go for the big ones?
Yeah.
And just try and get them right. And then, you know, years later, I think as much of a production line as I think Marvel movies have been, what they've done really well is just like going, this is the base level of what these characters are. You know, we've really nailed what the characters are, and then we can do interesting things with them, and we can amalgamate different ideas over the years of what these characters have been, but these are now the definitive versions of those characters. Mm. Whereas, you know, we're going to do a Fantastic Four film. Great, because no one's managed to do that yet. Yeah, it's going to be a body horror movie. What? Aren't they meant to be like a family? Isn't it meant to be kind of like a bit of like a family, light entertainment comedy take on a
super... It's going to be R-rated, and it's going to be...
And it's going to be about the horror of waking up one day and finding out that your body is not your own. It's going to be like Cronenberg. Okay, are you on Cronenberg right now? That's my little... we've got to play a song. Let's play a song and then never talk about this stuff ever again. And let's talk about stuff that we're actually a fan of.
Thank you.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
Hi, guys. We're back. What have you been a fan of this week, Nathaniel? Just before you answer, I'm just going to tell you what I've been a fan of this week. Because you ain't watched nothing? Or
no,
what?
I have watched stuff. I've watched a couple of things, but one of the things is probably not worth talking about yet. But you tell me.
We don't have to go into this because I think we've sort of vaguely covered it over the thing. Me and my girlfriend are watching. She's not seen any films ever. So every time I watch a film, it's really weird because when you're watching stuff, you're showing stuff to people that they have not seen anything. You know, sometimes I just want to watch Tommy Boy again. Or The Empire Strikes Back out of context without watching it with all nine of the others. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's sort of like, is it too soon to just read? I watched, Big Trouble in Little China 3 times last year. This year, once.
I do letterboxed and sort of mark what I've seen.
Yeah,
and then at the end of the month, I do a thing. When I look at it, I go, that's insane. What I've watched, do you know what I mean? You just think, none of these films are like big movies that people, they're not like new movies that people are talking about.
Yeah.
It's just like, I'm just following a muse now. Like, and I'm not watching things because I'm going, oh, I bet that's going to be good. I'm watching it sort of going, sort of just vaguely interested. And I watch them and go, yeah, it's fine.
The dream would be to watch every single film ever made.
Yeah, exactly. Just for the context.
We'll never do that because they bring out more films than we can watch, you know, every day, right? So my ultimate goal is to watch every film that's ever been made. And when you realise you can't do that, it's just got sort of. But I've seen your screen grabs of your letterbox thing. Interesting to see that none of the movies I'm in get reviewed at all. You just give them blanks.
Oh yeah, I could do. But then it feels like it feels weird, doesn't it, to do that?
What, to just give stuff that your friends are in 5 stars?
Blanket help, 5 stars. Yeah.
To help improve its visibility.
Okay, do that.
Yeah, or unrated, because it means it's a bit shit, but I know someone that's in it. I've done it. We've all been there. we've all got friends in the industry, mate. You host a show with me. 5 stars all the way, thank you. No, it's fine. It's nice that you watched them. So when you're like, well, watching these films, you don't really end up watching anything that you really want to watch, but you end up sort of like doing homework with your partner because you go, well, you've got to see this so that we can watch this. It was like watching all of the DC movies so that I could watch 4 hours of Justice League. And you go, but we're trapped in a flat together. I can't just sit down one day and watch 4 hours of Justice League. Hey, we'll make it a communal activity. You want to watch Suicide Squad? I'm looking forward to the new Suicide Squad, though. Stallone is a massive fucking shark. Yes, please. We went back and we watched. We started the Mission Impossible franchise.
Oh, nice. I've just remembered 2. Sorry about that.
That's what we did this week. So Mission Impossible 1 is so dated and crazy. And it's sort of quaint.
I've watched it recently, the first one. I think it's great.
But when you see what the franchise turned into, and there's so much like green screen. But I think watching them in sequence is so fascinating because you can literally see a franchise. They didn't nail it on the first one, and they took a massive step back on the second one. And then in the third, it's like, okay, so what we'll do, we'll make a franchise based on the Mission Impossible. And what's Mission Impossible? It's a team of people that go in disguises and costumes, and they have fake sets, and they'll get kind of like, it's set in the Cold War, and they'll get a Russian who's defecting, and they'll create this whole scenario around them that they're not aware of in order to see whether they're a genuine good guy or a bad guy. And then at the end, it will reveal how they did it, and, you know, and it's completely requires there to be a team of people, and we'll make it into a Tom Cruise vehicle,
yeah,
where we kill off the entire team, and it's kind of like they go, right, okay, so what are we going to do? Right, well, we'll have it's Tom Cruise, And then we'll get a superstar director who's got such a distinct style. We'll attach them to it. Yeah. And then there'll be like stunts. And they go, right. So they did the first one. And then there's the train sequence at the end, which is all green screen. And you go, yeah, yeah, sure. And the first one is brilliant. I think it's really good. Except for he's looking for the... What's the bad guy called in that? They've got a three-letter name. And he's looking for the bad guy. And he just types their name, .com, into the internet. And it's like the internet is so new. And so he's looking for like a secret assassin and he Googles them because nobody knew what the internet was. And so the first one is a great little thriller with some brilliant set pieces, right? Mm-hmm. And then they do the second one, and the second one starts off with this death-defying stunt where he's climbing up a mountain.
Yeah, right.
And it's John Woo. So they've got this superstar director who's got his own style. And it's Tom Cruise again, but we're slowly going to introduce team members, right? Ving Rhames is back, right? Great. And then the third one is like, okay, well, John Woo didn't quite work out as a superstar director. So let's just get a competent director, and it's Tom Cruise and stunts. That's what we're going to do. We need another death. I can't really remember the third one that much, except for it's got, Philip Seymour Hoffman in it, right?
Yes.
And they've taken J.J. Abrams from Lost and Alias, and they've gone, well, let's give him a go at making a movie, right? And it's still Tom Cruise, but it's not a superstar director. It's just a very competent director.
Well, TV director, I guess, at that point.
TV director, someone that will do what we basically tell him to do. Mm-hmm. And now it's really a Tom Cruise thing. And then the fourth one is, well, let's get Brad Bird to do his first live-action film because he's really good with The Incredibles. He knows how to do action with like animation. And then we'll get him up the top of that building in Dubai. Mm-hmm. And now it's all about, like, we'll get him to do stunts. Then you do the fifth one and you go, is it Christopher McQuarrie?
Yeah, yeah.
Who did Valkyrie and Jack Reacher, and didn't he write
Usual Suspects,
and he directed Way of the Gun?
Yes.
So you've got this guy, and he's not a superstar director, but Tom Cruise knows him. They've worked together, and now it's going to be like, I think getting a superstar director is one step too far, right? And it's one gimmick too far, right? So actually, we don't need a superstar director. What we need is a competent director. And it's all going to be about Tom Cruise and stunts. And that's what the franchise is now. Mm-hmm. And then when they did the sixth one, it's like, we'll get Christopher McQuarrie back. We won't bother with a new director every time. He did a good job. So let's just get him back and we'll do it again.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like you're watching them evolve like that. It's really weird watching the second one. The second one is shit. It's utter shit. Like, it's unbelievable shit. Like, I could not... I saw it at the cinema and it didn't offend me that much. And I was so into John Woo at the time. It's not even as good as Broken Arrow. It's not even as good as, like... So you did Hard Target, Broken Arrow, Face Off, Mission Impossible 2. And it is shit. It's, like, definitely his worst film that he made in America. It's awful. As a sequel to Mission Impossible, you know, watching it through the eyes of someone that hasn't watched a lot of films, hasn't watched any Brian De Palma films, really, hasn't watched any John Woo films. So she's not watching it from the point of view that this is a director. You know, this is a director to watch out for. This guy's good. So the contrast between watching the first one and the second one is like, this is a movie and this is like a TV pilot for a Channel 5 show. It's kind of crazy. And then again, I think it's really interesting that a lot of, or maybe not a lot of, but a few ideas are directly stolen from Darkman, where the bad guy has a cigar cutter and he cuts people's fingers off with it. And you go, that's in Mission Impossible 2. There's a gag with one of the Mission Impossible masks, you know, where a guy in Darkman has some duct tape taped over his mouth and a mask put on him. And when he's screaming, you can see, like, he's, like, shouting for help. And you can see, like, the silver under his lips. And then they shoot him, and then they take the mask off, and they realise it's one of their guys. And you go, oh, no, we killed one of our own guys because he had a mask on. And they just do that in Mission Impossible 2. You go, that's weird. And it's even weirder when you look at The Mummy, and you go, they stole direct sequences out of American Werewolf in London. Mm. It's kind of like, they're not huge films. They were kind of like cult classics that took time and have stuck. And I would say American Werewolf in London is probably more well-known than Darkman. But they're like these horror movies that were sort of not like shit films. They were well-liked films that have stuck around, that are made by some fairly big directors. So you haven't kind of like just picked like a TV movie and taken a bit from that. You've taken these great bits from these great movies that aren't huge movies, cult classics, and you've put them in these Tom Cruise movies and gone like, yeah, there you go. You know, they're some of your best ideas in those movies, and they're taken from other films. It's weird. But Mission Impossible 2 is a real standout because you kind of like go, right, they've really... This is awful. Or the slow motion is annoying. Tom Cruise's haircut is annoying, which is only there, I suppose, because of the slow motion.
Yes, yeah.
Because he has short hair and all the others, so kind of like, and you get the feeling, right, we've got John Woo, and his first comment was, right, you need to grow your hair because we're going to be shooting 50% of this movie in slow motion, and you're going to be... It's weird. And it is also quite weird to try and work out who Ethan Hunt is and what that character is. Because watching it back, he's a very cocky character that's got a lot of kind of like one-liners that don't really work. And I guess they're sort of like ironed out a little bit as the franchise goes on. But I remembered him as more of kind of like an angry, intense, straight character. But when you watch it, he's kind of like, he's like this barrel of laughs that's kind of making wisecracks with Emilio Estevez and kind of like, hey, I'm going to have a pint with Ving Rhames. Do you know what I mean? He's kind of like, he's like this laid back. I'm fun. I'm a fun guy. It's just, it's kind of
I think I always think the first one is the kind of gold standard. And I think they have kind of, they've really chopped away at it till they've got something now which is replicable. Is that the right word? Like you can replicate it, you know, it's that. But I think that first one, there is something great. And I think the most riskiest bit in Mission Impossible, which I think could have ruined the whole movie but works, is that first taking off the rubber mask reveal and having like a kind of bam, bam, bam. And it tells you, yeah, we're going to be doing silly stuff in this, even though it's the 90s and we're supposed to take things really seriously. But we're still going to have someone pull a rubber mask off. And it's going to, and you go, and I think it actually made the audience go, yeah, this is what I want from a Mission Impossible film. It isn't trying to do it more seriously. And as soon as it does the opening credits, and it matches the old opening credits with the huge wick that's lit, and I think that's the selling point. And also, I thought one of the great things about it was that thing used to in a TV series. It's when they show clips of the movie you're about to see in the opening credits. And I think that's such a great idea. And it's, again, taken from the TV show where it's about ratings and an audience. And if you're watching the TV show, it's like, oh, this is going to happen in the next hour. And you've got things blowing up. So in the opening credits, you're going, oh, I'm going to watch this because I've just been shown. And I sort of still think it's a really neat idea.
It's great. It's great. It's like... when you've got Mission Impossible, Mission Impossible as a series had enough gimmicks in it that you could go, yes. Whereas Man from U.N.C.L.E. was kind of like, oh, it's a Russian and American.
Yeah.
That's the gimmick. And The Saint was kind of like, it's Roger Moore. So when you're redoing The Saint, it's kind of like your big problem is that you've got to recast Roger Moore. And they did that with Val Kilmer. It's kind of like, The Saint didn't take off. So... Mission Impossible is kind of like you don't need a star because you've got the masks and you've got the impossible mission and you've got like spies. Yeah. And
if anything, like Mystery Men, it probably should have been an ensemble. But that's its first big thing, isn't it? That they've gone with basically it's a series with an ensemble cast of lots of people with different skills. But when we do the movies, it's a star vehicle for one man.
But... they do sort of they do a bait and switch where the beginning of the film is we're introducing Emilio Estevez and literally we just watched Young Guns and my girlfriend was like great Emilio Estevez and then you go he's brilliant isn't he you're gonna love this and then he dies and she's like what and it's like a genuine shock and you're just like I know and then it's like you've got Tom Cruise in this film who's literally Oh, God. Like, if you're a fan of the TV series, and this is a follow-on from the TV series, it is a, it's like a jaw-dropping, oh, my God, they've killed off the team.
And so also, what... at the time, Christian Scott Thomas, who'd just come off of Four Weddings and a Funeral, and was, like, again, sort of very much on the rise. And that, as a the team they have at the start, is a totally believable mid-90s star vehicle. It's like, wow, that's your lineup.
And John Voight was meant to be, was it Robert Graves?
Yeah.
From the Mission Impossible series. And Robert Graves was like, I'm not doing this because you're not treating my character with respect. Yeah. Isn't he meant to be the same character as well? He's got the same name.
Yeah.
But Robert Graves didn't come back to do it, so they recast it. But I think that's fascinating because it was kind of like, no, this isn't just a spin-off from the TV series. This is a sequel to the TV series.
Yes.
This is a continuation of the TV series. I think that first one, exactly, is great. And, you know, you were talking about rebooting James Bond, what would you do with it? And you go, just make a really good spy movie. Make something that's got twists and turns, it's really interesting, and it's kind of like, I'd even take a step back from, like, the huge set pieces and the special effects and just tell a really decent, thrilling story that keeps you on the edge of your seat. You know, you go back and watch those 90s, I'm not saying do a James Bond film like this, but, like, you know, you watch The Fugitive, and it's literally, it's so tense. And it's a guy trying to get information whilst being on the run.
Yeah.
And it's just such a sort of streamlined idea, but really tense. And that was based on another TV series. So I guess you had Mission Impossible and The Fugitive. It's just like, well, what else can we do? Maverick. We'll do all these films. I think that first Mission Impossible film is great. But then with the series, they were like, right, well, it's not just going to be the gimmicks from the TV series. What are our own gimmicks that we're bringing to it? So we have all of the TV series as the base level. And then on top of that, we're going to build in, it's Tom Cruise doing an actual death-defying stunt every time. And that's what you're going to come and see. And he's tried with other franchises, you know, Jack Reacher and The Mummy, where he's gone, we'll take a mummy movie and we'll make it about Tom Cruise. And we'll take Jet Reacher, which is a series of books about a 6'7" blonde CIA agent. And Tom Cruise has gone, well, we'll make it that. So, and then it's like Mission Impossible is like, it's a series about a team and we'll make it about Tom Cruise. So every time he goes into a franchise, he tries to get a franchise off the ground. It's kind of like, he'll take something that is badly fitting for as a star vehicle for him. And he'll sort of like try it. It's like square peg, round hole. He's just jamming himself into all these projects. And it's like Mission Impossible. Really, I think it really works. So, but the second one is terrible. Over to you. You've got a minute to tell me what you've been a fan of.
I tell you what I have been a fan of. I've seen The Suicide Squad, but I might wait till you've seen
it. The new one?
Yeah, seen it.
What do you think? Better than the original?
Oh, yeah. It's better than the original, for sure.
Is it good?
I liked it. And it was, but it's a real up and down journey for me. I think it earns its next 10 minutes every 10 minutes. You go, no, I'm not sure. Then something will happen and you go, I like that. And it's like that all the way through. I thought it was like something good or funny happens every 10 minutes until you get to the end and you go, I found that really satisfying because I'm constantly amused by it. I'm constantly like, yeah, I like that. I like, that's a good idea. That's a good idea. That's a good idea. The end. It's like, great.
Okay.
I liked it.
And is Stallone good?
He is good, yeah.
He's in a very little bit there, right?
No, not really.
Oh, really? Yes! Oh.
But he's like, he's very much, it wouldn't have taken him long to
record his lines.
Yeah.
A morning.
he was in a studio for a morning.
Great. No, great. Brilliant. Oh, well, I'm really excited about that. I'll watch it and then you can talk about it next week. And also for our listeners, if you're listening live week by week, we'll give you all a week to catch up and then we'll talk about Suicide Squad.
Yes.
We've all got homework this week.
Let's do some fan mail, shall we?
Great. Oh, yeah. Hi, Nick. Oh, I've lost my voice today. I've got a bit of a frog in my throat. Hi, Nick, Nathaniel, Natalie, and Brian. I watched The Lost Boys when it was on TV recently and loved it. Kiefer Sutherland is a beautiful man. What are your favourite sexy horror films? Cheers, Maggie.
Sexy horror films. What's a sexy horror film?
I think Fright Night is... it's weird. It's not one of... It's, I wouldn't say it's my favourite film, but I think Fright Night just... I love it. I come back to it regularly. It's funny, it's scary, it's creepy, and it's also kind of Chris Sarandon is kind of like really, oh, what's the word? He's sort of really creepy, but he's shot like he's sexy, but it's got 80s. It's weird. He's wearing sort of like this trench coat, but they've gone, because it's the 80s, but they've gone, we'll make it look a little bit like it's a cloak as well, because he's a vampire. And so he wears this really disgusting grey, like leather trench coat slash cape. And there's sort of like things in it, but it is quite a sexy film. But I wouldn't say that I find Chris Sarandon particularly attractive. But
a film I certainly found sexy growing up was An American Werewolf in London.
Well, it's got that sex scene.
Yeah, yeah. Natalie's pointed out that Bram Stoker's Dracula, Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula, it was a sexy film. Okay.
Yeah,
I can see that, I guess. I can see that.
And obviously the ending of Society is one of the sexiest moments in any film. If you've not seen Society, don't read up on it, just watch it. It's really sexy, but make sure you take your trousers off first, because you won't have time when it gets started.
It's gone. Natalie, interestingly, has pointed out that The Exorcist... I don't think The Exorcist is a sexy movie in the slightest.
I wanked. I thought... Fucking hell. Did you see that? Were you made of stone, you know, Nathaniel? Her head went 360. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I can't really think of any other horror films at all. Sure. Hi, guys. I was doing a show in the early days and then didn't keep up and have come back to it a while ago. Great. Thanks. You sound a bit lonely. Has the no new film situation given you the blues? Thanks, Stefan. Why do we sound lonely?
Well, we don't know.
Could it be because of the global pandemic, you stupid fucking cunt? Right. Hello, I like your film talk. I'm not a big believer in films, but I'd like to get started. I've seen Dumb and Dumber and Schindler's List. What films would you recommend? Dumb and Dumber and Schindler's List.
I hope you watch Dumb and Dumber afterwards. That's the best way around, I would think.
I found one of them hilarious and the other one tragic. I'll let you be the judge on which was which. Well, that's a really crazy couple of films that you... Mm. The only films you've seen.
And we don't know if you liked them even. So it's difficult to put...
I think you're on your own a little bit. I think if you just watched any other film...
You should watch Roberto Benigni's Life is Beautiful.
You should watch Roberto Benigni's Pinocchio.
Yeah, that's your next one.
You'll believe a 56-year-old man is a little wooden boy. He's done it again. He's done another version of Pinocchio. He followed up Life is Beautiful with Pinocchio, and then he's just done another version of Pinocchio where he's Geppetto this time, and you just think, fucking hell, man. Jesus Christ. He's got a real hard on for Pinocchio. Right, well, that's our letters this week. We'll go to a song and then we'll get our guest on, right?
Yeah, let's do it.
Time is straight and right.
And Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back. We're back live. We're not live. We're pre-recorded on a Wednesday. It comes out on a Friday. And we're back in the studio. We're not in the studio. I'm in my spare room and Nathaniel is in his washroom. And we are joined now by writer, actress, comedian, presenter, all-round comedy legend, Helen Lederer, who's here to talk to us about the launch of the 2021 Comedy Women in Print Prize. Hello, yes. Helen.
Hello, Nick. I'm really well. Quite hot, though, because we can see each other and the love your wonderful, loyal listeners can't. I think we're all quite shiny. I mean, you are, Nick, in a good way. It's not a criticism, but you are shining.
Well, see, I've got... you're saying it's hot, but I'm really cold. I've got my window open, and it's a grey sky outside, and the grey sky is reflecting... across my giant forehead, and I just look all washed out, but I'm freezing.
Oh, okay. No, and that wasn't a criticism. It was just like an observing thing. I mean, what about my backdrop? Would you like to talk about that?
I love your backdrop. It looks like you've got sort of plants growing amongst bookshelves.
Yes.
It's kind of, it almost looks sort of fantastical.
Yes,
sort of
surreal.
Like a Midsummer Night's Dreamy kind
yes.
of. Yes, it's got that sort of vibe.
You're so
to it,
artistic,
it?
Both of you, aren't you? Already, like you conjure your images, your wordsmiths. I know you. I research you, but also there's a trick thing for that screen that won't be very interesting to, because it's a photograph that I had made into a screen out of the anxiety at the Zoom thing.
Right,
and so it's a trick. It's not real.
It's
a screen. It's because you can see the ending of it anyway. But how lovely this great program, Comedy Women in Print, in its third year, so the aim is to it's quite. Do you know anything about it, or do you want me to drone on in a like? What's the thing here? What should we do?
Well, you launched it. Well, I tell you what. Here we go.
Yeah.
We've just played your favourite song, which was
Message to You.
Message to You, Rudy, right?
Rudy.
So what is it about that song that you like?
I know you're both brilliant stand-ups. That was the sound. Was that my sound? Did you hear that?
No.
Because we're on headphones. And we're doing so well. So doing the stand-up. So I just, help me, Lord. So were you in Edinburgh 2 years ago, both of you, doing your great shows?
2019. I was there 2018 last.
2019, yes.
And Nick was 19 and Nat. And I were up at the same time, so 18, right? Mm-hmm. So that was me going back to see if I could even remember, like, sentences to say in order on stage. So I went back as an old person doing stand-up. Sort of, yeah. And I just have that music, and you just need, how do you get going before you go on stage? I just need that music to go, yes, come on, and go for it, yeah?
Do you mean like walk-on music, or do you mean like as the audience are getting in, you play them something?
Good question. As the audience are in, I need to get them into a frenzy. That music is subliminal frenzy potential, right? So it's just to get people going, hey, yeah, I wasn't that happy, but here, okay, a part is with some money. I don't know what Helen's going to be like now. I used to see her like 500 years ago. Okay. Oh, this music. Whoa. And then they start getting in the zone. Yeah. And then you come into a climax of that kind of ska music.
Yeah.
And that's it.
I think it's really important, the audience getting in music.
Yeah.
I use.
What do you have? What do you play?
Well, I normally have like a combination. The years that I really liked was I had a combination of AC/DC and Aerosmith. I like rock music, and it's okay. Sort of stuff that you don't really hear in clothes shops when you're walking around every day. So when you invite people, or when people come to see you on stage, and before you've come out, they get like a little taste of what to expect and what your tastes are.
Yeah.
And you get to sort of like control the room.
Mm-mm.
Even before you've entered the stage, by picking the music that they listen to. Yes. While they're waiting. I think it's really important.
It's so important. What do you have, Nat? What's yours?
I have it different for every show. I try and have something that's vaguely themed to what I'm going to be talking about, maybe. But then I also have like a thing that I really like, which is Sammy Davis Jr. once recorded lyrics to the theme to Hawaii 5-0.
Oh, wow.
And to me, it is the most upbeat piece of music.
How would that go? I don't know. I don't know how Hawaii.
If you get in trouble, you can call on me. Even if you are near you or across the sea.
I will
think of something to do. I'll be on the lookout for you. It's like that.
That is so empowering. That's kind. That's empowering. You're in somebody's hands. Everything's going to be all right. They're looking at nice.
It even says in the lyrics, you can count on me.
Count on me.
So I think you're subliminally telling an audience, it's going to be fine, isn't it?
Oh, God, yeah, that confidence.
I trust.
You both do this, and that's so nice to kind of talk to modern practitioners. You know, that do you think it, like you have to be like a sheepdog slightly, you know, sort of keeping your eye on the audience, like round, like that Nick was saying, control. You know, you have to control that nobody leaves. Well, some people might leave, but, you know.
I think it's more to do with kind of like you're setting out your stall and... If you can kind of like give people like an inkling of what to expect, do you know what I mean? It's kind of like you've got an hour in their company and you're kind of like going, right, this is what we're doing.
Yeah.
And it's not so much that you're controlling them, but you're taking control of the situation and going, we're in my hands now for an hour. And, you know, then you're going to go out and do something else.
Yes.
But the moment you walk into the room, we're in this together. I think it's exciting.
I agree. And also, yeah, the pleasure principle, you know, like obviously one's got heightened adrenaline before. I was crying actually. I was having my hair washed in Harvey Nicks because I, in those days, couldn't wash it myself properly, which is ridiculous. That's one thing I've learnt in lockdown. It's a terrible admission. And I was crying in Harvey Nicks about something or other. And she said, told me to go down to Princes Street, get the that CBT oil. Right, so yeah, then yeah. I just kept taking more and more, and I don't know if it made me stir. I don't know, but I was really happy. So it is that kind of happiness principle that you're all in. Yeah, you have a transaction, don't you? So I would tell them about the CBT oil, and I would just, you know, and hope that experience was a positive one. But it was never the same. Every night was different. Yeah. Is that the same with you?
And also days of the week are different. Like people's energy on a Monday is different from a Saturday, and sometimes Saturdays are the worst day because people are drunk. Like they've had all day to drink, and
expectations. Yeah. That gladiatorial, make us laugh.
But the other thing about But the other thing about anticipation is that also I really like theme parks and the queue to get to the theme park, because the ride is sometimes 30 seconds and the queue is half an hour, 45 minutes. And so if they do the queue really well, you can enjoy the queue as much as you enjoy the show.
Yeah, and then that's when people bask in the queue, don't they? Because it's a captive audience. But that's quite a scientific analysis there, Nick, about the timing. So you're timing the queue and then you're timing the ride. And I've not thought of that before.
And if you, but it's not just queuing to get into the show, but like once you're in your seat and the music is playing, then you can kind of like, you can whip them up into a frenzy without even doing anything, just by playing the music.
Yeah.
So by the time you appear on stage, they're like,
Oh, here we go. Come on. Who is this person?
Another good technique is to get on stage half an hour late as well, because by the time you're on stage, they're really up for it.
Oh, no, they've left and they hate you. Like, there's so much grumble. In fact, I mean, I was reading you did the training. I need to speak to Nat as well. I don't want Nat to feel left out of this, my interview on your show.
He's all right. It's fine.
He's happy with this. Oh, good. But then I read, Nick, that you had trained the conservative person, Baroness person.
Saeed Avasi.
So all these tips that we're sharing, because I also have done stand-up in my time, I love talking to other comedians about those, you know, because we know without being mean to the people who haven't done it, we know that we've all done that. So I'd be quite curious to know what it was like to get a person, and what was the purpose? I mean, was it for a TV show, or just because she needed to be a stand-up as opposed to a politician?
We were put together for a show last year for Stand Up to Cancer. And the show was called Stand Up and Deliver.
Okay.
And we were meant to film it in January, but it got delayed. And then we ended up filming it in November and it came out in March.
Mm-hmm.
And it was good.
Oh, my iPlayer, that would be interesting to watch.
It'll be on Channel 4 somewhere.
And okay, they have those things. You can get them, can't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I think it's 4AD.
In the world.
It was a good learning process, but I didn't want to be paired up with a Tory.
So what did you do? How did you dress differently? Did you speak in a different way?
She did in the end.
Casuals? Casuals for stand-up?
It was very easy to get bogged down in the politics.
Yes.
And not get any work done. So yes. I just tried to work out what she wanted to achieve as a human.
Great question.
And then
I want that one. I love that question.
She was about to be
a life coach, Nick.
It ended up being, I'm not going to take any more. She was very good. She does public speaking, so she could.
Yeah.
But it was about breaking down what her public persona was, and then building up what she had to offer as a comedian.
And not everyone does have something to offer as a comedian. I've noticed that when people talk about. I was somewhere else the other day, and they were saying that the nature of comedians' personalities, you know, like as if we're not better or worse than anyone else, are we? But I mean, I wouldn't say we're particularly normal, but what is normal? Nobody's normal. But there may be some common characteristics about a comedian in that we might be a bit moody, I don't know, or want to be a loner. We want to be outsiders. Everyone's an outsider, so that makes none of us outsiders. But, you know, there's stuff in common, isn't there, with comedians?
I think so. I remember, being a thing that when I was in dressing rooms with comedians, I thought it was a weird thing that you did, even though you wouldn't necessarily have something in common. You all have something in common that you can't really put your finger on.
Yes.
But you sort of all kind of immediately you've got something. And it's not just because you're all about to go on stage.
Yeah.
It's there's something in common when you talk to people which is absent. And you do feel a bit like, oh, it's you guys.
Yeah.
Even though, like, as people, you might not have anything in common.
No.
You might be like, you know, if you're having a chat about something, if you're meeting them in another context, you might struggle to start a conversation. But I always think that in that thing, I always felt like, oh, connected. These guys, there is something. You totally. Are like me somehow, but I don't know how.
I think it's about the pain, though. I think it's the fact that I have respect. Like, it's just like, you know that we will all have done maybe some good gigs and some not so good gigs. And that is it kind of unites. There's a uniting factor about that, that yeah. you would have done what I've done, or in your own way.
I know that when I was starting out, and all the people that I was starting out with, I would have time. I've got time for anyone that's given stand up a go. You know, yeah. you don't have to be a good stand up comedian, but if you've given it a go and you've tried, then I've got time for you. And I ended up, you know, it's not necessarily the best stand up comedians that you've got stuff. Nathaniel aside.
where are you going, Nick? Come on.
but you know what I mean? It's just, I think that stand-up comedians are all very different from each other. And not everyone, I think I see things in my way. I'm not saying I'm unique, but I do know that other people don't really see things the same way as me. And I just think, I think stand-up is really difficult, and to do it, I don't know.
To sustain it, to continually do that all your life, which you do. Now, I think what is said, yeah, okay. So I would agree with both, though. I think that, like, I had to do some interviews with new comedians, or comedians that had made it in their region, some kind of premise that got the money for this program to be done. Anyway, and I didn't know them, and we're all from different, you know, wherever, but I did enjoy the chat, because it's that belief, it's that somebody's ready to dance with you. It's just that, you know, you just feel, you know what, once we get going, then there's an availability of the brain. Well, it's just about connecting. You don't have, but I also know what you mean, Nick, about sometimes being old as well. It's like I can't watch the programs at the moment because I'm not in any of them, so I just I cannot watch television programs with all the panel and the this, and then going through hoops or standing on things or going downstairs, whatever it is, because I'm not in that group anymore, so I can't identify, and I have to be age appropriate. But I do. But I also am quite critical. Are you? When I watch other content, I'm going, is this funny?
I can't
in a mean way, but no, I just can't connect.
I can't watch comedy. I don't enjoy it. I watch cooking shows. They're my favourite things.
Oh, okay.
But also, it's kind of like...
I can't do cakes. Oh, no.
I'm not into baking.
I cannot do those cake things. Please,
baking,
not
no.
more.
No.
Just why? Just
no.
I don't get.
Rick Stein. If it's Rick Stein, then I can watch. I can watch him going around Cornwall, but yeah, I'm not interested in baking.
On a little campfire on a pebble beach and seeing a bit of trout cooked, I suppose I could be interested in that.
Or films, but in terms of comedy, I'm supportive of everyone, and I'm sort of like happy that everyone's
nice.
Got their career. But at the same time, I'm not getting my inspiration as a comedian from watching other comedians.
Very well put. What do you think now? I'm liking this conversation.
I think it's interesting. I think generationally, I feel different from comedians who started even sort of 3 or 4 years after me, almost. I think the turnover changes so much.
Mm-mm-mm.
And there's lots of people I don't know, and you think, well, who are these guys? Because you didn't really start off at the same time. Or
it's like being at school
exactly.
in your year.
Exactly.
Because, in my year, when I started, there were, like, two other women, and they both had to have the same name, Jenny. So, so there was two Jennys and me, and that was my year. So you don't check, and then you know who's the year above, don't you?
Yeah.
And then you might hang out. You might hang out, and you're like, and I'm talking about it as if I still do it. Like, I'm trying to wear the war wounds and be cool with you two because you're young. But I did do it 2 years ago. I mean, I can do it. I kind of transfer it now on the old literary festival. So once I was, written my book and I got going on the literary festivals, I thought, wow, this is good. Because one, people want to come and see you. You know, you're not sandwiched between other comedians. Like, they're forced to see you, your 20 minutes. and I really, that was the first time as a over 50-year-old person. But I just thought, I'm really enjoying this now. And so you can be a bit, go somewhere where before you always be very careful or like scripted or go to the gag and all that. Maybe that's just getting older. But it's quite nice to just go, I can just be myself. And I might be funny in this moment, but I might not be funny in that moment. Like now, I don't think I've been that funny. I think I've been funny twice so far. But we've had quite serious chat, haven't we? But I can be funny if I'm in the moment.
I think that that's exactly what I enjoy most about performing, is that that it might be funny, it might not be funny, but it won't be a waste of time. You know, you're kind of trying to do something that isn't necessary. You know, I think it's quite a brave thing to do, is to do something that isn't necessarily aiming towards the next punchline or the next gag.
Mm-hmm.
And you're kind of like, it shows, and I'm not just talking about myself, but it shows sort of like a level of confidence where you're kind of like trusting the audience to kind of go with you on some stuff.
You've got to, I agree with that, but what if? I mean, then, so my problem, I waver between huge confidence and huge insecurity. I mean, that's, and so you go, oh my God, this is indulging. If I'm missing the beat, I know I'm not being funny. If for some reason my brain, like today, I'm a bit like hungover, so the brain isn't quite firing. And I know that I'm not fired. And then you go, but I totally get what you're saying. But then, oh my God, what an indulgence. I feel it's so indulging. Indulgent, whatever the word indulge. I just feel I'm indulging myself. I'm not connecting with the audience. People see this old woman rambling. And you just go, oh my God, this is torture. This is torture for everyone. I should leave, you know?
Sure. But within your own framework and within your own kind of like scale that you judge yourself, you are capable of still being crap. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
You know, there's a difference between deliberately not aiming for a laugh in that moment and telling a joke badly.
And
it's kind of like, if you can kind of like hold an audience's attention,
yes, and be genuine,
then you don't need to be funny. But if you're telling a shit joke, then it's kind of like, well, that is a waste of everyone's time.
It is, know? And also the repetition. I always struggle with the repetition of the gag. I don't know how you both find that when you know there's a joke. Because you've written it and it often and it mostly works. But then you go, oh, just doing that joke now. And then they're just like, oh, coming up to the joke moment. Oh. And that is quite, oh, and then you feel ashamed that one is almost too knowing. I don't know. It's a very complex thing. Yeah, I want to know them and them to love me a lot. You know what I mean? I just need that love. It's very ego.
Yeah, absolutely. But one of the things that I thought when you were talking earlier about talking to other comedians, I think it's kind of like, I find comedy very scary, and because we've all sort of like worked out how to do it ourselves, you know, it's kind of like talking to other comedians can be comforting because you're like, I do that. And it can also shed light on what you do. And you can go, oh, I've never thought about doing it like that. Or you go, fucking hell, that sounds insane the way you do it. I'm actually happy the way I do it.
Yes, all of that. I really do think you could be a life coach because but all of those examples rely or assume that there is a connection because we're taking something meaningful from all of those options. Because I would probably, in a conversation with a comedian, have all of those things going, one, I don't feel so lonely because you've talked about that. Two, you go, wow, you've given me a great idea. That's really liberating, you know, to hear somebody else's strength and or struggle, right? It's very, it's awe-inspiring. It just, it's a huge interest to me. I'm really interested in how you do it, like genuinely interested. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that it's that sort of like, maybe there's an easier way to do it that would make my life a lot more simple and a lot more comfortable. And, or maybe I've just hit on the only way that I am able to write a joke and get on stage and tell it.
Yeah.
And maybe that's me. It's also sort of like, I'm trying to tidy my flat at the moment and it's an absolute shithole, right?
Yes.
And I've got quite a small flat and I've got too much stuff and I'm shifting stuff from one room to another, to another.
Stressful.
And that is almost a illustration of how my brain works and how I do comedy, right?
Yes.
And you can go around to someone else, another comedian's flat, and it's all tidy like and clean.
Is Nat's tidy? Nat has got less things in his flat than yours, Nick.
Not just got less things, he's got no things.
No, but this is basically, I pretend, because I've put the computer in a room where there's less, so people don't have to see the horror of other rooms.
Okay, so how are you communicating then if there's no computer?
Oh, no, this is the computer's in this room.
Oh, sorry.
Because if it was in a different room, it would be.
I get really worried. I need to understand everything you're saying now.
On this subject, I sometimes worry, I like the idea that stand-up is in some way, at its most lofty, when I think of it, I go, oh, actually, we're doing something, there's something magic that I don't quite understand and I don't want to know about it.
Yeah.
At the same time, what I also think is, what I've probably learned is a series of cheap tricks that trick me and an audience into laughing. And I can't tell what the balance is. Like, have I just learned, you know, certain like weird techniques that subliminally on purpose I've learned that tell an audience to laugh? Or am I doing something which feels a bit more special or a bit... I like to think of it that you're doing something...
Oh, that's quite self-critical, isn't it? That's the danger of thinking too much, because then you can think yourself out of it. And you, like I was saying, repeating a joke, then you feel it's not genuine. But then, like if you're in a play, you have to everything is new. That audience never seen you before, so it is like an experience that will never come again. So you just have to be very existentialist and just go in this moment.
Yes,
and then just charge for that hour, whatever. But that's interesting. God, I think we're quite interesting. I hope we're not boring people. Do you think we're boring people? Because we'll say, would you stop talking about comedy now? Who do you think you are?
We can stop talking.
I haven't told you about the important thing, apart from the fact that now I want you to be my friends or something like that as comedians, comedian counsellors.
I liked you as soon as you.
I liked you. I liked
really?
You. Really?
I just need some laugh today, actually. Do you ever have that? Just need a bit of affirmation. A little bit of affirmation.
Yeah.
I don't even say the word. A little bit. And you go, yes, I know who I am. They know who I am. I can do it. But then when you have like a whole day or 2 days of things going wrong and no affirmation, it's amazing how you lose the, I'll just walk on stage and, you know, do this.
No, absolutely. I need that affirmation, but I'm too scared to ask for it. So
Okay, well, that's an admission.
I think there's people on Twitter that are very good at sort of like going other comedians that are very good at like going, oh, I'm having a bit of a tough day, can everyone tell me that they love me, whereas when it's me, I just go quiet for like 8 days and then
does anyone call, do people bother? So are you helping yourself then, Nick? Possibly not. I think even fake affirmation, I'll take it. Do you know what I mean? Because it has to be relatively fake in this world, because who knows anyone? But I just think being nice, or thank you letters, or thank you emails even. Like even after this, I'm sure the lovely producer will go, oh, thank you, Helen. I really liked it when you did X. I just think those, like a little detail, a bespoke detail, is that old-fashioned? I just think, you know, like, two sentences are better than thanks for doing it.
I think,
you know?
I don't know if it's old fashioned, and I don't know.
Comment on that. I won't draw you on that.
No. All I know is that it's not necessarily the way that you've been treated in the past. It's, you know, it's do as you would be done by. You know?
Yep.
It's like, oh, do you know what I would appreciate? Whenever I've done a podcast or I've done something and I haven't had a text afterwards to say, it's all okay. You haven't cancelled yourself. You haven't destroyed your career.
Don't.
You haven't said anything that you're going to, you know, it's all okay. That was a great podcast. That was a great show. That was a great TV recording. That was a great whatever it was. If you just get that, and if you don't get it, you're there just sitting there going, well, what did I do? Did I?
Exactly. But it's like, it is a nice, do as you whatever, if that was a Bible parable thing, is it? I don't know.
Jesus. I think it was Jesus.
Was it Jesus who suggested it originally?
Also, something like this is tricky because we're all on a Zoom call. So at the end of it, we're all just going to be on our own again. We're going to turn a thing and we're going to immediately, we're not going to go home. We're not going to travel home. We're not going to pop back somewhere and say goodbye to each other. We're all just going to, this is going to end and we're all just going to be sat in a room by ourselves. And then we go, oh.
Doing the next thing, or I'm well, I because I am wanting to tell the people, you know, you very kindly invited me on. Probably somebody suggested you did, but because the Witty Comedy Prize I set up 3 years ago has just had its long list, and so obviously I would like people to go on the Comedy Women in Print website to see that. And it is. Did you? I mean, it sounds like I'm not selling it. I'm selling it so much.
Let's do this.
I sometimes feel a bit dull when I talk about a thing that is not. I'm much more interested in talking about stand-up comedy, but I want people to know about witty women's writing. I do.
Well, let's do this properly.
Okay.
You've had a long career. You've done a bit of everything over that time, and it got to 2018, and you've said. There's a gap here, and I want to create something that's going to shine a light on comedy women in print, and you're going to create a prize for it. So why did it come about in the first place?
Yeah, thank you for asking.
Why at this stage in your life and your career did you feel it was necessary?
Because I wrote my first comedy novel in 2015, and then I had been a judge on various things. And then I said, I looked around rather hopefully for a prize to win. And there wasn't one I've been a judge on the Women's Prize. And I know that prizes don't necessarily produce the best, in quotes, product. And particularly, God, you know more than anyone with comedy. So you can't because I've been in plays and things where people are incensed when they're not amused, when they're told that they should be. I mean, comedy produces so much anger. So the thing is to go, okay, we've got let's introduce a broad sweep of different types of wit now. I think wit's much more empowering than funny in a way. And so one is confessional, one is satire, one is this, one is more domestic, you know, fine. Nothing is right or wrong. But what wasn't happening was it was very difficult for unpublished women writers to become published. And looking around, everybody wants to be a writer. And there is amazing talent out there. And it's only a drop in the ocean. But it seems to have, the entries have doubled. And it is... I have turned myself into kind of an admin stressed person looking at emails. I mean, I'm so bad at it. Also, I'm a very bad manager of people. So I'm not playing to my strengths by doing it, but I can't stop now because it's created careers for unpublished writers because HarperCollins publish the winning book and they give them $5,000. So we've created a situation that is real. And with the runner-up prizes, they get placed on an online MA in comedy of Falmouth. We've not done those. And creative, right? So it's meaningful rewards, meaningful platform, meaningful visibility, but it's not enough. And so I know I'm not doing enough in various areas and people are very quick to tell me I'm not doing enough. But then I'm going, oh, I'd quite like to do a show again. Oh, I've got to finish my memoir where I talk about sex in the 80s and see if anyone's interested. You know, I want to do stuff before I die, really. And I'm, how many years have I got left? Probably about 10 tops before I have to live in a bungalow or something. And, so I've got to do the stuff now.
I think you're doing plenty by the sound of it.
This is very negative the way you're looking at it.
I am so negative, Nick.
I think you should be incredibly positive about it. When you say you're not doing enough, are you saying that people are telling you you're not doing enough in terms of you're not doing enough in terms of promoting comedy women in print?
Or... Well, I think because my bit of it is because when HarperCollins came on board to actually publish the book, that's wonderful, so that the unpublished writers go through the portal of the website, but they so it's judged blind and it's free, but I was made aware that the winner, the long-listed were not people of colour, which is and I hold my hand up to that, and we made a little statement, and now I'm very excited about trying to do something else. But is that, you know, positive action is really important, but then tokenism is also a problem. We can do better, but you know, if you're thinking about witty women writers are a microcosm of stuff anyway, it's very difficult to achieve everything when I'm not even in charge. I'm just in charge of my emails and also, trying to
it's very
be nice
difficult
to people.
For you to achieve everything by yourself.
I'm not a politician, you know.
I think that from my point of view, I have picked, so I do a charity gig every year, haven't done it in lockdown. I do it for shelter because I'm very passionate about homelessness, and I think that's something that we should get rid of. And that's my hill that I will die on, right? That is something that I will do. And if I do a charity gig, that's where the money goes.
Yeah.
That's what I do. That's my contribution.
Yes.
Right? And yes, you could give everyone a pound, you know, or you could put all of that money in one revenue that you think is worthy. And it's not saying that you're not saying that that's the only worthy thing, but you're trying to do something and you're trying to say, well, this is the positive impact that I am trying to make on
as a person,
as an individual, on this group of people. Or you could be overwhelmed at all of the issues.
I am a little bit overwhelmed because especially, and we're all aware of it, you know, one is on Twitter. I mean, I'm very sporadic, my own thing. I'm hit and miss, and all I want to do is like write something a bit weird, and then somebody else does it weird, and then you go, oh, that's weird. And I love that whole chain of weirdness. But that's a rarity now, because I'll do charity like you and support other comedians or support causes, because that's useful. It's a platform, but it's not so much that kind of witty place where you can do banter and stuff. And then it is a useful place for people to fish out injustices, and there's a relevance to all that. But also deep down, there's a time now where there's fear that through innocence or intent, that it will all go ugly and wrong, and you won't be heard, and then you go, why, and shall I just get back into bed and not do anything, kind of thing. Yeah, it's scary times right now. Would you agree on social media?
Yeah, and to be kind of having a career that is based on public image, or being out there in the public, I think it's difficult. I also think that there's sort of been a breakdown in people don't tend to give people the benefit of the doubt anymore, and you can make a mistake and people will look for the worst in it as opposed to the fact that there's an innocent mistake.
And it's helpful. I mean, I really agree with that. And you just go, you know, people, we made the statement and people were commenting, you know, you've left your egos at the door. That's great. You know, and you just, it was a graphic, you know, it's like all you can do is say we can do better, and that is a message, because another person might have missed that. You know, it's not, I probably am not unique in making a mistake in fields, but it's that corny thing. It's what you do with it. Turn it into a positive and go, if I made that mistake, a lot of people make that mistake, so can this be useful? It sounds like a bit of spin, though, doesn't it?
I always think that about Twitter and things. Twitter always strikes me as it's the wrong platform for people to operate on, because it's built on this idea that you can only say a thing in a really short amount of words. And it's silly. It's the idea of people are trying to have very difficult, complicated arguments on a platform that only allows you to use a certain amount of characters.
It's just ridiculous. It's just about the right platform to test out one-liners.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, it's like, it's or to put a link to an article.
It's a link to say, this is funny, or that's on, or... or find a song, like I found this weird song on YouTube by Melanie we wouldn't even heard of, like I Ride My Bicycle or something. And then it just got all sorts of lovely people like John Dowie, like the people that I knew in the 80s would that was beautiful because you're doing a memory. Then other people go, oh, I was in the audience, went, great. Then that's a connecting thing. But actually, you're right. The shortness can be quite elliptical. It can be fun. It can actually, the shortness can make something funny because less is more. So there's that. But then, as Nat's saying, anything else, how are you going to do it?
In terms of nuanced debate, it's just sort of like, whoa, hang on. And, yeah. You know, you're writing it and you're going, well, this is too long-winded for Twitter, so I'll leave that out. But then the thing that you left out is the one thing that actually you needed to leave in to get your point. It's an absolute minefield. And so in terms of kind of anything beyond, I don't know. It's like, we talk a lot about films on this thing. And I don't even know if it's worth saying. A trailer for the new Ghostbusters film got released last week. And I said, this looks quite good. Right. And people's instant reaction, because they did a remake in 2016, which was all women. And it didn't do very well at the box office. And so they've made a sequel to the Bill Murray one from the 80s. Right? Okay. And so I said, this one looks good because the trailer looked good. And people come in and they say, well, they should make a sequel to the one in 2016. And you go, well, I'm not talking about any other film other than this one trailer. But this thing that I have just seen, I'm seeing this as good. I'm not having an argument. I'm not commenting. Yeah, I'm not commenting on
just this.
Movies.
Just this.
Just this 2 minute trailer that I quite enjoyed. I've said this looks good. This is not a political debate. I am not like drawing a line in the sand. I'm not saying anything.
That's so funny. That is so typical.
Even something as simple as watching something, enjoying it, and sharing it turns into a debate, and you're like, whoa, 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 I don't want
that. Then if you don't do that, Nick, I mean, if you're not, because people want to see your take on it. I mean, there is an interest. I was actually out today, but, you know, people are constantly on their phones, just check it. I mean, it is part of our landscape, isn't it? Very successful actresses, probably. Like, I'm thinking, I read an article, somebody said they just weren't on it. Oh, can't remember who now. But I'm thinking, well, maybe you don't need to be on it. A famous actress in some magazine. Anyway, so you just go, oh, okay. So some people just, that would be quite beautiful, wouldn't it? To actually not be part of it. But then how can we do that? We can't not be part of it.
Well, it's putting the genie back in the bottle. And I think
really,
it's impossible to have local conversations, and everything is a global conversation, and everyone lives locally but online has an international presence, and it's kind of like, what is applicable for the area of London that I live in and how I go about my daily life will be different from how it is in Middle America.
But as a comedian, do you not have your own followers and, you know, who have a pleasure and an expectation of your kind of genre? You know, like they go, oh, I wonder what Nat's thinking today. I wonder what Nick's going to say today. You know, there's a kind of thing going on that you have to, that it's good for you to keep providing the fodder for that because there's a market for it. So
I think there's some people that are built for cannibalizing and documenting their life from the minute they wake up in the morning. And, you know, I go on Instagram and there's people that are really good at sort of like posting pictures, and maybe they'll do 10 pictures a day.
Yes.
And I'm lucky if I can come up with one picture a day.
Yeah, maybe, and where you're looking nice.
And it's, but I hardly ever post pictures of myself on Instagram. It'll normally, if it is, it's me wearing a mask. And normally.
But what do you take pictures of? Because they can be quite dull. You know, when you see inanimate, you go, why am I interested in that stapler? Why? I need to know more. It's like, you have to have faces. But then, do you do that thing where you're in a restaurant, like, you know, a restaurant booth, with, like, surrounded by people, and then you take a snap of yourself, and everyone is looking very pleased that they're in the restaurant booth, and we're all supposed to go, wow, you're in the restaurant all together having a meal. Wow. And then that's it. It repeats.
No.
We're in another restaurant having another meal with different groups of friends.
I take pictures of abstract things.
Okay, so you're a state, but you're probably going, hey, look at this plant.
It's weird because you're in an industry where it is all about attracting attention to yourself.
Yep.
And in reality, I find that shameful and embarrassing.
Yep.
And so I will take a picture of maybe a shoe that I am wearing and post that, but not my face.
I will look at that. I would be interested in your shoe because I'd be interested in the caption you would, although I don't think Instagram encourages too many captions, does it? I think the picture has got to, this is a shoe, would maybe just be enough.
It's, I don't know, caption.
Try and sustain interest, but I might need guidance with a few words of your take of the shoe. So I encourage you to do, but I will, I have to get people who I'm with to put, to do my Instagram. When I'm with them, I hand them the phone like a child and just put this on.
It can come across as sort of like, you know, you can say, this is my shoe, but then you could just put shoe, ... question mark. And then it comes across as needy, do you know what I mean?
Because
you
know, you want confidence. It's back to your confidence, though. It's back to, you know, that the joy that you can give. You know, like assuming, if you assume that you've got something to say, then other people will assume the same thing. It's contagious. So
I assume,
have to be confident.
I assume I've painted myself into a corner and I can't do anything else, and that people, I'm regularly surprised. I say regularly surprised. Mm. I'm not regularly surprised.
No.
I am always surprised when people seem to be happy that I've turned up. It's like, I've got a fairly low opinion of...
Low
confidence and low self-esteem. But there are sort of like tricks about getting up on stage and getting yourself to do it.
Yeah. Well, that's... We've come full circle in a way. That's not to be controlling, but, you know, when we were saying about, like, the characteristics of a comedian, like, we've all contributed a bit like that. I mean, you know, I'm a bit down myself, at dealing with... how to do better, shall we say, and like on the school report, can do better, that's true. That I have to do better, but I have to do better. I think we're all quite insecure people, but I think we're quite funny. Like, that insecurity is very humorous, that assumption that people aren't really interested in us. We're just conflicted, right? And that's interesting.
Maybe it's not the confidence to be confident. You know, and maybe it's the confidence to be able to say that you are lacking in certain areas and that you are actually voicing what other people think, you know.
Yeah, well, that's it. But that's the comedian. That's the thing of the comedian, that we're saying the unsayable, but we're saying the thing that connects. Because then why would you laugh? Why would anyone laugh at you if they didn't absolutely get your, like they say, the truth? I mean, that is... that we are saying what other people, we are saying it in such a way that it can be recognised. That causes the laughter.
I think you only
get laughs if people recognise what you're saying.
Yeah, and I think in other circles of life and in other industries and in other professions, the aim is to portray the fact that you've got your shit together and you know what you're doing. Whereas in comedy, you can go on stage and you can say, I haven't got a fucking clue, and people... are relieved to hear
that
whatever is swimming around and exploding in their brains is true for other people as well.
I would like to go and see you do that one, that show. Like, I haven't got a fucking clue. That will probably be the next show.
I think
people go,
I think all of my shows.
Yeah, a riff on
people
that.
People go, wow, that guy really has no fucking clue, right?
So I like that. And then this was my version of that. I don't know if we're ever going to talk about anything else, but my version of that when Nat and I were up at the same time was that I'd have my script, I'd have my CBT oil, and then I'd have my script just sort of stage left, right, slightly hidden on a table. And then I just go, oh, okay, just got to pick the script up. Just got to pick it up now. Or before that, I got bad. I said, where was I? And the very dutiful people who go, you were just outside the massaging in Charing Cross. Thank you. So then I could, and it just turned. And I just thought, you know, I've just got to do this. I've got to look at my script. And I've got to get the audience to remind me where I am.
I
don't know if that's good or bad, but that was all
that
I could
offer.
That
becomes its own style, though, right?
It has its own style.
But it is.
That's what I would do. I write on my hands and I have notes. Because at the end of the day, if they're laughing and they're enjoying themselves, that's the job. the job, I've never thought of the job as, this is a memory test. I've thought the job as, it's a test.
Oh, the memory, Like, if you're acting, can you imagine, like, lines? Because you have to do your lines, because otherwise people get cross with you because of the cues. Like, another actor might really mind that you might do a Nick Helm going, oh, I'm a fucking clue. Go, no, we're on the stage now, and you have to say that line so I can say that line.
Yeah, sure.
And the memory is, and I remember, like, Christopher Biggins on some, like, loose ends, I, you know, like, you do those things, and he was going, oh, why, darling, why? All those lines. And so, but when he was young, he was in, like, up Pompeii and things, I think, you know, and you just go, maybe there comes a point when you just go, I don't want to learn lines anymore. Well, anyway, what else should we talk about? Have we been talking for 5 hours?
We've got 3 minutes to talk about something. Right. So can you just clarify, and we don't want any tangents, just stick to this, right? So this Comedy Women in Print Prize 2021, the long list has been announced.
Yeah, of the published and the unpublished. And interestingly, on the published, I can't pronounce it even now, Mel Gudrike, you know, her book, Andy Osho, Diksha Basu. We have some really funny, weird, broad sweeps. A very good one is that where people go into disaster zones. That intrigued me. It was a Korean translation, and that's funny. I thought, that is funny. I'd be interested to read about going into a disaster zone as a comedy. And then we have the shortlist in September, and the winner is in November, and then we do it better even next year.
So who votes?
No one votes. We have, like, a diverse range of celebrity judges, like Maureen Lipman, Steph, who does Pack Lunch, that programme, Steph McGovern. We've got, like, stand-up comedians, I don't know, it's on the website, so I can't remember, sure, there were 2 seconds left, like, amazing, from old to young, Gloria Hunniford, Tanya Moore, stand-up comedian, probably gigged with her, like, people who know stuff are judging.
And there's the panel. And then when do the results come out?
When the party that you're all going to come to is in November, and that's when it's about announced. Do you think we'll be in lockdown again in November?
I think we'll be dead in November.
What? What did you say?
I think we'll all be dead in November.
Oh, no, don't. Let's not go there.
We'll be positive. There'll be a party in November.
Yes, there'll be a party. We'll all hang out.
It'll be a great Zoom party. We'll all be...
Free drinks. No, real. It's going to be real. I'm going to get gin. Yeah. Everything's going to work.
Yes. Well, please invite us. And we'll.
Yeah, no, you're on the list. We got your email.
So the party's in November, and that's when the winner's
in bank. Thank you for being organised about this interview, Nick.
I just wanted to get your message across.
Bless you. Thank you. Yeah, my message is... have I got the message? Has it come across at all?
I think it has come across. It's been very interesting for me, because also I'm talking, but I also want to point out, I feel a need to point out, that you're talking about something as someone who's much more... unsuccessful than the pair of you, then it feels almost like I'm agreeing on things, whereas actually you're talking about things from a slightly different perspective. So I just want to say,
what's your perspective then?
Well, I feel like mine's always a little bit different, because I don't feel like I'm in the same sphere, but I think there's an advantage to that.
Yeah.
I feel that I think there's an advantage of being quite anonymous.
Okay. But you're
and
not.
I quite
I
enjoy
know
it.
Your name, Nat. You're a comedian, and you're called Delightfully Silly, and I think that's very liberating. So I like that. I like everything about you both and the programme now that I've been on it. Thank you for having me.
This proves, Helen, that you've done your research.
I
know.
That automatically makes you in the top tier of guests.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Absolutely top tier.
Well, okay, we've got time for a quick game of the game Better or Worse, where, Helen, I'm going to pass you over to the capable, if anonymous, hands of Nathaniel George Metcalfe. Take it away, Nathaniel. Let's play the
game. Helen, this game is called Better or Worse, and you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before, based entirely on my opinions to score points.
Okay, so I've got to project what you would be thinking.
Exactly.
Oh, that's clever. Otherwise, I get so anxious because I don't want more people to hate me.
No, it's fine. It can only be. This is exactly it.
Clever concept.
So, beginning with Björk. Is Vincent Price better or worse than Björk, according to me?
Better.
Better.
Better. Phil Collins, better or worse than Vincent Price?
Worse.
Worse.
Worse. Orson Welles, better or worse than Phil Collins?
Better.
Better.
Better. What? Clive Owen, better or worse than Orson Welles?
Worse.
Worse, because I can't remember Clive Owen. It's an actor, isn't he?
Yeah. Owen Wilson, better or worse than Clive Owen?
Better.
Oh, that's funny. Better.
Better. Richard Gere, better or worse than Owen Wilson?
Worse.
Worse.
Oh, did I get that wrong?
Oh, no.
No, you got it right.
Wow, you got it worse. Oh.
Richard Branson, better or worse than Richard Gere?
Worse.
Worse. Richard Attenborough, better or worse than Richard Branson?
Better.
Better.
Better. Michael Douglas, better or worse than Richard Attenborough?
Worse.
Worse. Michael J. Fox, better or worse than Michael Douglas?
Better.
Yes, better.
Yes, it's a 10!
You got a 10! You got a 10! You got a 10! I got a 9, but you got a 10! That's amazing!
I've never done that. Oh, that was anxious.
You got a 10
any
out of 10.
Any scoring situation can raise my blood pressure. I'm in danger now. Expiring.
Helen Ledger, you got a 10, which means that you are better than Dame Baptiste and Marina Sirtis with 9, Baz from Massive Wags with 8, Jamie Adams, Carl Gass, Izzy Sooty with 6, Sarah Gibbs, Laura Jean Marsh with 5. You are
that's
currently...
Poor. 5 is poor. Isn't it? It's a poor result.
It's poor. 5 is absolutely fucking appalling. I don't expect anyone to have any worse than that.
5.
But you got fucking... you are the top of the leaderboard at the moment.
I think I may have been assisted, but I'll take that. No, I've got 10 out of 10 today, and I'm you've made me happy.
It's hard. It's tough. It's tough getting into this anonymous man's mind.
Yes.
You certainly did it. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. We'll meet again on the circuit, on Twitter, at the party, in the shopping mall.
You're writing a book at the moment.
I'm writing my memoir.
When you've finished it, would you come back to the show and talk about that?
Yeah, that will be specifics. Then I'll go into specifics because there'll be chapters.
Sure.
So you can go talk me through chapter 3, Helen, or something like that.
Yeah. Great. Yeah? Great.
It's focused.
Brilliant. Well, but until then, welcome to the Fan Club Clubhouse. You got a 10 out of 10. You should be very pleased with yourself.
Thank you.
So it's goodbye from me. It's goodbye from Nathaniel.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from Helen Lederer.
Goodbye.
And everybody, look after each other, be nice to each other, and we're almost out of the woodwork, but don't be a cunt, because we might be right back in it again. So, have fun. Bye.
If you get in trouble, bring it home to me. Whether I am near you or across the sea. Something to do. I'll be on the lookout for you, and I'll find you. You can count on me. And don't you let them get you up against the wall, cause I'll be there to catch you, and I won't let you fall. And if they all desert you and you start to bend, you know I won't let them hurt you.